Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Mary Meller, and I will be today's host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through a generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here on campus, locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or go online to www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is The U.S. Foreign Service, Behind the Scenes of American Diplomacy. Today's guest is Nicholas Krolev, author of America's Other Army and former Financial Times and Washington Times correspondent. Krolev has been given unprecedented access to the inner sanctum of American diplomacy in Washington and around the world over the last several years. He will talk about his new book, America's Other Army, which is based on his visits to more than 50 U.S. embassies and interviews with over 600 career diplomats, as well as Hillary Clinton, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, and Madeleine Albright. For a decade, Krolev traveled with these U.S. secretaries of state to over 80 countries as a newspaper correspondent. Today, he will share behind-the-scenes insights about high-level foreign policy decision-making, and we'll discuss how the work of American diplomats affects the daily lives of millions of people around the world. He will also examine whether the Foreign Service is equipped to address the challenges of the 21st century and what needs to be done to improve it. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Okay, what happened to... here you go. Oh, it's on this screen now. Great. Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming. What I thought I would do is tell you how I came to this subject and why I decided to be not only interested in it, but delve into it and spend years researching it, and why ultimately it's important for all of us to know more about what American diplomacy is, what American diplomats do, and why they do it. And the story for me actually begins all the way back in 1989, when some of you weren't born. But I was 15, and I was in Bulgaria, where I grew up. And that's, of course, when the Berlin Wall fell. And until that point, I had wanted to be a theater director. But in 1989, in Eastern Europe, it seemed that the theater was in the streets, because for the first time in their lives, millions of people had the chance to express themselves freely after decades of communist rule. So I decided to become a journalist because I wanted to tell these stories of what was happening, what it meant for all of us, what the consequences would be for people in Eastern and Central Europe. And I became a university student, but also at the same time became a journalist and a reporter for the evening news of the Bulgarian National Television. And through my work and my studies, I had my first contacts with American diplomats at the U.S. Embassy in Bulgaria. So through them, I began learning about the role American diplomacy had played in ending the Cold War. I'm not saying American diplomacy ended the Cold War, but it did play a role in it. And it played an even bigger role in the years to come, in the transition to democracy and market economy that all these countries experienced. And years later, I realized that nothing of what's happened to me since then would have happened had it not been for those events that American diplomacy actually played a role in. I wouldn't have come to the U.S. or gone to school at Harvard or become an American citizen or been a newspaper correspondent, traveled with the secretaries of state that were just mentioned, or written this book. In other words, American diplomacy has affected my life. So I wondered, am I an exception? Does American diplomacy affect other people's lives? And so when I went to the Kennedy School, and after graduation in 2001, went to work full-time for the Washington Times. But even before that, while at the Kennedy School, I already was working for the Financial Times. And my first trip with the Secretary of State, in fact, was in 2000 with Madeleine Albright. So I was meeting these American diplomats around the world, and I was wondering what it is they do every day. And you might think you know what they do, but believe me, you don't, because I didn't. So, unfortunately, and you've seen these faces several times, at least, I'm sure, since the fall, since September, but these are the Americans killed in Libya on September 11th of last year. And I found that, unfortunately, the media and the public seem to pay attention to diplomacy and diplomats only when people get killed. And so what I would like to do, or one of the things I'd like to do, is to get people to think about this issue more often than when blood gets spilled. And when I started doing my research, you know, as a newspaper correspondent or as a journalist, you travel to these places with the Secretary of State or with the President, but you see a very superficial, you have a very superficial glimpse in what's happening at these posts, because an official visit, like the Secretary's visit or the President's visit, occupies so much of these people's time that you don't really see what they do when you're not there with the Secretary of State. But I wanted to dig deeper and find out not only what it is they do, but how they do it and why they do it. So I began my research back in the fall of 2003 for a newspaper series, an 8-part series I did in the Washington Times, which ran in 2004. But there were three main questions on my mind when I began the research. And the first question was the one on the screen. Why should we care about diplomacy? Really, how does it affect us? Does it affect us? Or is it something practiced on some level up in the sky that, you know, we see these people in ties and suits on TV, or, you know, shaking hands and negotiating with North Korea or Iran, but so what? How does it affect our lives? Then the second question was, what is diplomacy in the 21st century? Is it what we perceive it to be? Is it what it was 10, 20 years ago? And if it's different, how is it different? And why is it different? And the last question was, what do American diplomats actually do specifically? That was the most difficult question to get answers to, because one thing that the American Foreign Service is not good at is being specific. They love generalizations, they love being vague, and sometimes in diplomacy, being vague helps. This is not one of those times. It was like pulling teeth. I would ask them something like, well, I would say, if you were back home, because this was happening mostly overseas, so I would say, if you're back home and you're speaking to a domestic audience, and you asked, what do you do for a living, what would you tell people? And I was getting answers like, we advance a positive agenda. What? That's your profession? I'm sorry, I know what a teacher does, I know what a doctor does, but this just doesn't sound serious enough. You'll tell a 9-year-old kid that that's what your profession is? Just doesn't make much sense. You know, some people say, you know, I ask a question then that they begin with, well, it depends. Well, okay, here you go again. Well, why does it depend? I know it's a complex world, but there has to be a way to tell me what you do in one sentence. And then others will say, well, we represent the United States. Okay, a little more specific, but still, what does that mean? If you ask most people, I guarantee you they'll say that it means going to cocktail parties every day or waving the flag or whatever. Is that what you do? So it was a challenge to pull this out of people and to make sense of it all. But was mentioned, with these questions in mind, I, over those years, so beginning in the fall of 2003 through last spring, I visited 52 embassies and consulates, some of them twice. And interviewed these 600 Foreign Service officers and the last 7 Secretaries of State. Actually, the 4 that I covered and traveled with, and the 3 before them, who were Warren Christopher, James Baker, and George Shultz. So what I thought I would do is I'll quickly introduce to you only 4 of these 600, just to give you a quick glimpse of what kinds of things they're doing today. And again, try to make sense of it. The first of these 4 is Cameron Munter, who until recently was the American ambassador to Pakistan. Probably the most difficult job in the Foreign Service today. He was one of the few people who watched the raid that killed bin Laden in 2011 live at the embassy in Islamabad, which was only about 30 miles away from where the events were actually happening in that compound. And then, of course, it fell on him and his team at the embassy to explain to the Pakistanis why on earth they had no idea that a foreign military operation was taking place on their own territory, which wasn't the hard part. It was much more difficult then to repair the relationship, because when something like this happens, clearly affects the relationship, which already was tense enough. I mean, the bin Laden raid happened 3 months after an undercover CIA contractor killed two Pakistanis, claiming self-defense. 5 months after the bin Laden raid, we had a NATO airstrike that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. So three major events in 2011, that had such a huge negative impact on the relationship. Before Pakistan, Cameron was the ambassador to Serbia. And in 2008, the Bush administration recognized Kosovo as an independent state, which clearly the Serbs didn't like, because it used to be a part of their country. So a few hundred Serbs attacked the U.S. embassy in Belgrade. Somehow, not many people knew about this, that the U.S. embassy was attacked. Actually, part of it was set on fire. And fortunately, there were no casualties. The Marines didn't have to shoot anyone. But what happened a few days after that attack, the ambassador got intel that the person who had approved the attack was none other than the Serbian prime minister. And then the ambassador decided that he would do everything in his power to make sure that that prime minister lost the next election. Is that interference in another country's domestic affairs? You be the judge. But he thought that no leader in any country had any business approving an attack on any embassy, not the U.S., not any embassy. And so he took it upon himself. He didn't even tell Washington. Condi Rice had no idea about this. But he engineered a very intricate behind-the-scenes maneuver, and the prime minister indeed lost the election, which was 5 months after the attack on the embassy, and he hasn't been back since. So before Serbia, Cameron was the leader of what was called a PRT, a Provincial Reconstruction Team in Iraq, which was in fact the first PRT at the time in 2006. And he was up in the north of Iraq in Mosul. And what he and the team basically did was teach the Iraqis in the province how to govern themselves. Because, obviously, under Saddam Hussein, self-governance didn't exist in Iraq. So that meant teaching them how to build infrastructure, how to pave roads, how to build schools and hospitals, how to set up a judicial system. Sounds basic, but none of this guy had ever done before. And no one trained him to do it. He had to figure it out on his own, read up on it, and make sure that the members of his team knew about the different aspects of all this. The second of these four is a lady called Yuri Kim, who is a Korean-American. And she is currently the political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Ankara, in Turkey. Political counselor doesn't mean that she is a political appointee. She's a career diplomat. It's just that's what the position is called. But as you can imagine, she has spent a lot of time in the last almost now 2 years working on the Syria crisis, because, as you know, thousands of Syrians have crossed over into Turkey and living in refugee camps. At the time Cameron Manta was dealing with the embassy on fire in Belgrade, Yuri Kim was in North Korea, which was unusual because there are no American diplomats in North Korea, right? Well, she was there accompanying the New York Philharmonic, which had a concert in Pyongyang in 2008. She had actually negotiated that visit. And she'd also taken part in the nuclear negotiations with the North Koreans at the time. And in fact, the concert tour was a carrot, because as you know, we have carrots and sticks in diplomacy, right? So the concert tour was a carrot for the North Koreans to do certain things that the U.S. wanted them to do on the nuclear front. The third of the four is David Lindwall, who until a few months ago was the... that's different. That's the political military counselor. Not political, it's the political military counselor in Baghdad, at the embassy in Baghdad. The big embassy with thousands of people in it, being reduced currently, so downsized. So what political military sections at embassies do mainly, is selling American weapons and other equipment to the host government. And David told me that since the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003, the Iraqi government has purchased over $16 billion worth of American weapons. Before Iraq, David was the deputy chief of mission in Haiti, where he managed the search for missing Americans during the earthquake, after the earthquake in 2010. And his house actually collapsed, and he would have been killed had he been home at the time. And before Haiti, he was the deputy chief of mission in Guatemala, where one of the things he and the embassy did was to help reform the Guatemalan child adoption system. Did you know that American diplomats reform child adoption systems? I didn't. Why? What's in it for us? I mean, Guatemala is not exactly at our doorstep, down like Mexico, so why do we care about child adoption in Guatemala? Well, it turns out that many Americans adopt children from Guatemala. In fact, at the time, Guatemala was number 3 on the list of countries from where Americans adopt children. The only two countries from which more Americans adopted children at the time were Russia and China. So the problem was that the system was so corrupt that these American parents were wasting thousands and thousands of dollars on bribes. That's why the embassy cared, and of course Congress, pressure from Congress didn't hurt. But that's why they cared enough to spend the resources they did on reforming the child adoption system in Guatemala, which in fact was successful. Corruption is difficult to eradicate and it takes time, but it was considered a success. And the last of the four is Gavin Sundwall. Go from Lindwall to Sundwall, but it's a coincidence. So I met Gavin in Beijing in 2003, where he was the chief of the American Citizen Services section at the consulate in Beijing. And that is the place where you go when you're in trouble overseas, right? The American Citizen Services section. You could go there as a tourist, if let's say you've been mugged as a tourist and you need help, or you've lost your passport and you need a temporary passport to come home, or you live there and you need to register the birth of your child, or maybe someone died and you need to register the death of an American citizen. And obviously, every consular section and any embassy or consulate issues American visas to foreigners. But one of the first things Gavin did, coming in as a consul officer in the service in 1998 in Panama, was to pay a visit to a prison. So he was there, imagine, a young officer, a few days in the country, sitting in a jail across from two killers, that self-described satanist killers. And he was there because they were American citizens, and that's what happens when you're a consular officer. You have to go to prison to visit American citizens who've been arrested to make sure that they're being treated humanely. And he just came back from Afghanistan, where he was the spokesman for the embassy in Kabul. If you remember, there was a case a few months ago when an American soldier went around and killed 16 Afghans, civilians, if you remember that. And I think the trial began a few weeks ago. And then a couple of months before that, some American soldiers were videotaped burning the Quran. So imagine how you explain that away to the public in Afghanistan as the embassy spokesman. I mean, I don't know how that you do explain it away, but clearly it is a public relations nightmare to have to deal with this, given that American soldiers were the ones who did that. Okay, so I don't know how many minutes this was, but I know more than 5, I don't know if it was more than 10, just that the four people. But here is the list of what these people have done, limited to what I said they'd done, because Cameron Munter has been in the service since 1985. These three things that I mentioned are just the last three things he's done. There was much more before that. But here is this list. And I'm sure one of the things that American embassies and consulates do that I didn't mention until now is promoting American business. Because whether it's trying to expand markets for U.S. companies or create new markets, that's what the Foreign Service does and is supposed to do. So here is this short list. When I looked at this as a thinking human being, an outsider with great access inside, but essentially an outsider, I asked myself, how is this humanly possible? How can you expect teaching effective governance, nuclear negotiations, cultural events, reforming child adoption systems, selling American weapons, recovering from natural disasters, promoting American business, issuing passports and visas, visiting prisoners in jail, and fixing public relations problems? How can all this be part of the same profession? What other profession requires you to do all this? And this is not about having experts who do each of these things, no. A Foreign Service officer is expected to be able to do all of this. And the average officer would do maybe a third of this list in their careers and more that's not on this list. I just didn't want to be talking for 75 minutes here. But, when you think about the child adoption system, this wasn't even as ambitious as another similar effort that the embassy in Chile actually did in the late 90s, which was to reform the Chilean judicial system. This is huge. I mean, Chile is not a small country. And again, what was the problem? And the problem was, until then, which is a few years after Pinochet had left, Augusto Pinochet, the Chileans didn't have trials. One judge decided everything. They had trials on appeal, but not until then. And so the embassy, the Chileans wanted the help. They actually asked for the help, because it's difficult to reform anything in another country if the government doesn't want to reform it. But what the embassy did was not only bring down American lawyers and other legal experts, but what I thought was interesting was that they also brought down to Chile American architects. Why? To teach the Chileans how to build courthouses, because they didn't have any. They didn't have trials. Why did they need courthouses? But again, millions of dollars, thousands of human hours spent by the embassy to do this. So how does all this make sense? Why do they need to do this? Why do we the taxpayers, why do we have to pay for these people to be out there to do this? Can they do some of it from Washington? Why do we need to pay not only for their moving expenses and their housing, but also for their children's education? Right? Fair questions. At least fair to me as a taxpayer. So what I did is, having gone to the Kennedy School at Harvard, in my mind, everything you do in foreign policy has to go back to the national interest. Otherwise, it's a waste of time and money. Okay, I went to this document called the National Security Strategy, which every president releases once in each term, which I think means that Obama will release another one next year. But this is the 2010 National Security Strategy. And here is what it expects of the Foreign Service: to help prevent conflict, spur economic growth, strengthen weak and failing states, lift people out of poverty. Why? Combat climate change and epidemic disease, strengthen institutions of democratic governance. I'm sorry, but I get tired by saying these words. How do you actually do this? I mean, how much time and money do you need to do this? How many people does it take to do it? And is this about changing the world? Is this what we're trying to do? Why lift people out of poverty? Because we're nice? Because there's need in the world? Yeah, there's need in this country too. They're poor. There are people who go hungry. They're homeless in this country. Why do we need to be lifting people out of poverty? And it doesn't say, in certain countries that are strategic to the U.S. It doesn't say in this hemisphere, in this region. No, it's a blanket statement. We need to be lifting people out of poverty. Unfortunately, not many of my colleagues in the media ask these questions, but I'm seriously, you don't want to know why we need to do this? Okay, so national interest. The three components to the national interest: the security of the United States, the country's prosperity, and the values it stands for. The values are clear what they are. They're very much static. You can promote them, you cannot promote them, but they don't really change. Security and prosperity are clearly much more fluid and dynamic. So, to make the story short and not talk for another hour, the American government has decided, and it was decided back in the Bush administration and has been continued in this administration, it has decided that the only way for the United States to be truly secure is for the entire world to be secure and stable. Not our neighborhood, not the hemisphere, not Western Europe. The whole world has to be secure and stable. And that is because an internal conflict in any country can spill over and affect the region, a continent and ultimately U.S. interests, whether they're political or business interests. Clearly, we have Syria, a good example of spilling over. And things are happening in Mali right now, and you know how many people know where Mali is. But it's a big country, and it's an important country in West Africa. And in fact, it's a very good example of you know why we need to lift people out of poverty, or why they think we need to lift people out of poverty. And as someone who's never worked for the U.S. government, nothing of what I'm saying or I'm about to say is an endorsement or agreement with what the policies are. I'm just trying to make sense of them and explain them. So here's the thing, and this goes to prosperity. The same logic, in fact, applies to prosperity. So they've decided that the only way for us to be truly prosperous in this country is for the entire world to be, if not prosperous, because that won't happen in the next few thousand years, but at least to have as many countries as possible with functioning economies and some economic growth because of globalization, open markets, trade, social media, all this that you know that the world has become in the 21st century, the logic is that what happens economically and financially in other countries affects us. And all you need to do is look at the EU and Greece, and you have your example there. So, you know, going back to this question of why do we need to lift people out of poverty? Here's the logic. If you have a country in Africa, and let's take Mali, so what you need to do is have a government in that country that practices good governance. What does that mean? It respects its people's rights. It's accountable to its people. It provides basic services like water and food and electricity, things that we don't think about because we have them, but many countries don't. And also provides its people economic opportunity, which means jobs, right? And the logic there is, in these countries, Middle East, Africa, more than half of the population there is under 40 years old. A big part of that is under 25. If these people, especially the men, young men, if they don't have jobs, they would have to find other means to feed their families. And those other means might include turning to crime and terrorism. And that's what's happening in Mali. It's not only people coming in from outside, Al-Qaeda supporters, or, you know, it's also, you can't do this in a country without support from the local population. But you go around, and you round up these young men who are willing to go to terrorist training camps because they're promised a certain amount of money, and yeah, they have seven children, they need to make that money. So that's why they're saying we need to be lifting people out of poverty. Well, not literally, but by making sure that that country has a government that practices good governance, then that's what you have, a society, a functioning society with a functioning economy, with jobs for people so they don't turn to these activities, which, by the way, affect then directly the United States. Because if you recruit these men and you train them and then you put them on a plane to the U.S. with a little bomb in their underwear or their shoes or some other place that we haven't discovered yet, but that affects directly the United States. And that's how you connect the dots between poverty and the security of this country. So when it comes to the Foreign Service's mission, this is, you know, when the White House talks about this world, that they want to be more secure and prosperous so we can be more secure and prosperous at home, they call it, this is the world we seek. They know that this world doesn't exist yet. But they're saying, hey, Foreign Service, it's your job to help bring it about. Condi Rice used to call that transformational diplomacy. And I still use that term in the book because I think it explains it well. It's a good reflection of what this means. Many people don't like the term, many people in the Foreign Service don't like the term because they thought it was about imposing democracy on other countries or changing other countries in the U.S. image. And Condi Rice says that wasn't what it was about. It was about good governance, and I explained why. So we want to do, we you know, it's not about democracy per se, but when you talk about good governance, as I said, one of the conditions is an accountable government, which basically means elected government. So the White House recognizes that the world that they seek doesn't exist yet, and they also say, we also know that there is the world as it is. We live in it, and we need to deal with it. I mean, Libya happens, Syria happens, you need to deal with these things. And that, of course, is what diplomacy has been doing for the last several hundred years, which is managing foreign relations. That's traditional diplomacy. And so this is, when you put this together, and I arrived by pulling teeth, I arrived at the mission of the Foreign Service today, which is a dual mission. It is to deal with the world as it is and to help to bring about a more secure and prosperous world so the U.S. can be more secure and prosperous. So that is what these people are doing. And in traditional diplomacy, and I'm sure you know this, but there are four core functions. Managing foreign relations, which I mentioned, representing the U.S. and its people, which I also mentioned, assisting American citizens abroad, and the last one is what we call multilateral diplomacy. That's the issues you address at the UN, NATO, the EU, and all these multinational organizations. And as I also said, transformational diplomacy is all about good governance. And this means not only teaching other governments how to do things or how to practice good governance, but sometimes you just do it for them. What I mean by that, there is a guy in the book who was the U.S. ambassador to Chad. And when he arrived there in 2007, he realized that the government of Chad, a country right next door to Darfur, where genocide was being committed, didn't have a counterterrorism program. So he said, you know what, we don't have time to teach you people. We're just going to do it for you. We'll create the program for you. We'll still have to train you how to maintain it and how to work it, and that's what they did. They just created the program for the government of Chad. But this is the big thing in the Foreign Service now. It's not enough just to maintain relations with foreign governments. It's not enough just to go to cocktail parties. In fact, I don't think there are any cocktail parties right now in Mali because there are not many foreign diplomats in the country. It is about changing the world because you want to make the world more secure and prosperous so we can be more secure and prosperous at home. Clearly, very ambitious, very grand agenda. So let's see what resources they have to do this. This is the 2012 figures are not final yet. So this is the 2011. These are the 2011 numbers. And the budget for the State Department and other international programs, including foreign aid, was $53 billion. Foreign aid was less than 1% of GDP, which was $35 billion. And there are currently about 13,000 members in the Foreign Service. 8,000 what we call generalists, or these are the Foreign Service officers, or the diplomats. And then 5,000 specialists, which includes, the number includes not only, you know, when you hear specialists, that could be a secretary, could be a technical person or support staff, but also could be a legal advisor, could be a doctor in the Foreign Service, an accountant. Could be an information management specialist or an IT person. Both of these figures, by the way, are the largest in history. So this is a credit to Hillary Clinton that she managed to increase the budget to a level never seen before and also to increase the Foreign Service to a level never seen before. And this, in fact, represents a 17% increase of the Foreign Service. She tried to do 25, but even 17 is very impressive because nobody before her ever did it. So, how does this compare to the military? How many times do you think the military budget is bigger than the foreign affairs budget? Just for 2, 5, 10, 20, what? 50? Okay. What? Anyone else? We have 50. Sorry? 100? Well, you know. It's only 12. But the budget for the same period, the budget for the military was $640 billion, in fact. And there are 1.4 billion members of the armed forces. These are just active duty members. This number does not include reservists or civil service personnel at the Pentagon. So let me conclude with so what does this mean? Well, first of all, you probably will agree with this, but I find that most people, including the media, think that diplomacy is boring. It's just not interesting. I mean, the media doesn't cover diplomacy, does it? It covers high-level negotiations, North Korea and Iran, all that, but it doesn't really cover this stuff, does it? I mean, have you ever heard anything about this in the media? I haven't. So people don't realize that this actually does affect our lives, and there are great stories, and what I'm doing with this book is telling stories. I wanted to write an interesting book, not one that you're going to fall asleep on. I wanted to keep reading it. So it's all about stories, and these are people in the Foreign Service. So this was one of my techniques to make the book interesting, to humanize the Foreign Service and tell stories. And the second was to show explicitly the link between what the Foreign Service does and the national interest, which I did here quickly. So one of the things I'm trying to convey with this book and with all the talks around the country and in other countries as well is to at least inspire some interest in diplomacy and say, well, it is interesting. It's actually more interesting and entertaining you can imagine, especially the consular chapter in the book, because that's the consular issues are the ones that deal with people's lives more than any other aspect of diplomacy. But the other thing that I tell people, it's not only interesting, it's important because it affects our lives. And if these people don't do their job well over there, it does affect our security. But it's also the responsible thing to do as taxpayers, as citizens, to know what our money is being used for. And as little as it might be compared to the military budget, $53 billion is still more than the GDP of over 100 countries in the world. Okay? So it's still a lot of money. And I would like to know, I'm not saying that it's not being used properly, I just would like to know what it goes into. The sad part of all this is that you would think when you become a diplomat, and today they want a very diverse pool of people to come into the Foreign Service. You know, you take the written test, the oral exams, and they're difficult. In the last year, 22,000 people applied, only 400 got hired. But unfortunately, the State Department thinks that once, you know, the fact that you've passed the tests makes you already a good diplomat, meaning they don't really train you how to be a good diplomat. Colin Powell, when he came in, he was stunned and flabbergasted to find out that there is really no training in the Foreign Service. There's language training, there's consular training, but there's really no professional development in the Foreign Service. He tried to do it, he couldn't, and it still hasn't happened. And until this day, there is no professional training in the Foreign Service. You need to learn on the job, on your own. You have to figure things out. You have to figure them out on the go. You watch what others do and learn. Which is fine, because it is a profession where you do need to learn a lot on the job. Unfortunately, what that also means is that you over-rely on luck in the Foreign Service. This means that it clearly depends on who you work for, what you work on, and where you are at any given time. So you come in your first or second tour in the Foreign Service, and you have a good boss. Great. You'll learn a lot from them. You'll be fine. But what if you don't have a good boss? And there are many bad bosses in the Foreign Service, as in any organization of 13,000 people. Well, you're screwed, because you either learn the wrong thing, or you don't learn anything useful. And your career may be over before you know it. And I have stories in the book, actually horror stories in the book, about people who come in and they really don't know how to navigate the system because it's a big bureaucracy. Even as little, as small as it may be compared to the Pentagon, it's still a big bureaucracy. And you are not, I'm sorry, none of us is really born with the ability to be a diplomat. You may have something in your DNA that might make you one, but it'll take time to develop those skills and to make best use of them. So there are people like, for example, the current Deputy Secretary of State, whose name is Bill Burns. He is a Foreign Service officer, and he's been since 1982. He, everybody says he's great, But people say what makes him great is whatever was in his DNA when he came in. The institution has done nothing to make him into a good diplomat, and that's the way with other people. So it, to me, as a logically thinking outsider, when you bring in such a diverse pool of people, and it's really diverse. I mean, every profession is represented in the Foreign Service today, because for many people, the Foreign Service is not a first career; it's second or even third career. So great, you want the Foreign Service to look more like America. But that means that the people coming in today, most of them don't have any experience or background in foreign affairs. So, to me, this means that you will have to train them. Well, that doesn't happen. And it's all left to the individual to do it. When I asked every person I interviewed, how effective is the Foreign Service? Can it do better? Everybody said, yes, we can definitely do better. We are not there yet. And I think probably the main reason is exactly this, that there is no professional development in the Foreign Service. And it reinforces the notion, which I think is completely wrong, that I find most people think that, is that anybody can do diplomacy. People don't look at it as a serious profession. People think it's a hobby, which is why we have a third of our ambassadors are political appointees, right? With no experience or skills in diplomacy whatsoever. But the State Department, by not having professional development, only reinforces the notion that you can do diplomacy no matter what you did before, and regardless of whether you've been trained or not. And that's one of the things that I'm working on, and I can, if you're interested in the questions, ask me about what I'm trying to do to actually not only spark a debate on this outside the State Department, but also try to help the State Department realize that this is important. Because, as I said, it does affect us, and you can't just rely on luck. Really, the world is too dangerous, too complicated. In fact, I think what's happening in Mali, if you want to talk about it in the Q&A, I'm happy to, but what's happening in Mali, the embassy has been evacuated. There are no American diplomats anymore there. But the fact that these rebels have advanced so much, and they have these capabilities that they have now, that's, to me, a failure of diplomacy and intelligence. And that's why all this I said about good governance. If we are successful at that, we wouldn't be at this point now, to be bombing rebels, for the French to be bombing rebels. You know, we would not have gotten to that point. But anyway, so let me shut up here, and I'm sure that you probably have questions on your mind, and happy to try to answer them at least.
Great. So we'll allot the remainder of time to questions. If you'll just speak clearly into the mic, say something about yourself, and state your name for the radio broadcast.
Hi, my name is Corey Molcock. I'm actually going into the Foreign Service later this year, so I thought this would be an interesting discussion to attend. You mentioned that you had some ideas as far as what improvements can be made in the Foreign Service. Would you mind maybe just giving a brief outline of a little bit what you've come up with?
But the Foreign Service Institute is the key. There have been improvements under Hillary, but it's still not where I think it should be. And the Foreign Service Institute has 100 different classes, but and some of them are good. They're actually people from other agencies who attend those classes, and they're often oversubscribed. They're not many of the ones that are really good, but the problem is that my impression, and they actually allowed me to attend various classes last January and February, including A100, which is it's not training, it's, what do they call it, orientation. They are not good at connecting the dots, or they teach you something, but they're not good at explaining how it fits into the big picture of U.S. foreign policy. Which is actually trouble that many Foreign Service officers have, explaining how what they do fits in the big picture, but it's at least better than what it was when I first started doing this. So the curriculum, I think, at FSI is not where it should be. The teachers, many of the teachers, I don't think are good enough, and that comes from the fact that the best diplomats never teach at FSI, because you want them out in the field. You want them to work. Bill Burns has never taught at FSI, and he could teach many people quite a few things. So you have people teaching who are probably not the most qualified to be teaching, but they're there because, you know, they wanted to come back to Washington for a couple of years, or maybe they want their children to finish high school in the U.S. before going back overseas, or whatever the reason might be. Or maybe they're a tandem couple and their spouse has a job in Washington, they have to do something in those 2 years. And then the outside lecturers, as they call them, and many of them teach things, many of the things they teach outdated. You know, there I attended a class where the person who was teaching it, it was on negotiations, and the last time she'd done negotiations was in the 1980s. I'm sorry, it's a different time. You know, clearly there are some core things that still, you know, remain the same in negotiations, but in persuasion. But still, you probably could find someone who has done this more recently than 1985. So these are just, a couple of things. Yes. Well, we'll stay. Yeah, we'll stay where we are. Yeah.
My name is Nikki Eberhardt. I recently read your book. It was excellent. Thank you. My question is in regards to what appears to be unfettered access that you were given to both the embassies as well as the Foreign Service officers. What do you suppose was the motivation of the State Department in giving you that access? Was it in the spirit of full transparency with the intention to make improvements on their end?
They just love me. The Foreign Service is really happy when someone is interested in their stories. They would like more Americans to know what they do. They would like to be more appreciated for what they do, because they don't feel as appreciated as the military. Which is deserved, by the way, you know, for the military. But you know, they think, well, many of us are also on the front lines. We are in war zones, and we don't even carry weapons, but we are there, and we do actually sometimes similar work to what the military does. But people don't know that. And ultimately, it was after years of covering the State Department and traveling with the Secretary of State, I had some credibility, and they knew that I wasn't going to, you know, wasn't there to do a get you type thing or to screw them over. And so I guess they trusted me to do a good job. And so far, they're happy with it. They perhaps don't agree with everything, because the last part of the book, which is called Looking in the Mirror, is really looking at and, you know, trying to figure out what is being done well, what is broken in the Foreign Service, what can be repaired, what is beyond repair. This teaching diplomacy part, the training, you know, there's a chapter on teaching diplomacy, there's a chapter on navigating the bureaucracy. Still, you know, the biggest complaint in the Foreign Service is about promotions, that they're not transparent enough, about the bidding process, the assignments, again, that, you know, they're... And in fact, my conclusion is that the most important, and this is good for you to know, the most important thing in the Foreign Service are connections, okay? You may be the most talented person on the planet. If you don't have the right connections, you're not going to get the right jobs, meaning that you're not going to get promotions when you want to get promoted. So there's nothing more important than connections in the Foreign Service, and it's a club. It used to be boys' club, but now 40% of the club are women, so many women do succeed and have succeeded. But the point is, you know, the book is not just fluff, right? It's not just... I've tried to be objective and to show the good and the bad, and to present a realistic picture of what the Foreign Service is, what they do, and ultimately to you know, get people to think, people outside the Foreign Service, to get them thinking about what should be doing. You know, what kind of Foreign Service should we have? Why does no one ever debate why don't we debate these things? Why do we leave the State Department, and, you know, this is in any bureaucracy, you are insulated in many ways, right? You're in a bubble. In fact, I think many people in the Foreign Service live in a parallel universe. I think they're not very connected to the real world, but that's because they have their mission and they have their own reality of moving around every 2 or 3 years. And, you know, how do you raise a family in the Foreign Service? I mean, it's not easy to uproot your children every 2 or 3 years, especially when they're 7 or 8 or 10 or 12. So I'm hoping that at least you will be thinking about these questions and hopefully encourage others to think about them in the future, whether you read the book or not. And I think the gentleman over there had
I think we're out of time.
Can we take one last question? Because he had his hand up, and I'm happy to. Okay. Oh, for the show, for the TV show, we need to close.
So this will conclude today's Hinckley Forum. Please join me in thanking our guest.